Okay, welcome everyone to Elemental Awakening. My name is G. I'm a very special guest today, Jeff Lardon. Me and Jeff met a couple years back, just randomly our paths crossed, but there was this instant connection, like we were brothers or we knew each other, something like that. And our paths kept crossing. And you know, when I made this podcast, he was someone that really popped up that I wanted to chat about, because he's a really cool guy, down to earth, and really is authentic and sort of lives his truth. So thank you for being here, brother.
Well, thank you for those reflections. It's an honor to be here, and just a pleasure to be able to share part of my journey or whatever it is that we can dive into. And you know, somebody I've always greatly admired, so I honor you for the work you do, and it's just a tremendous honor to be here with you.
Thank you, brother. So if you like this podcast, please subscribe, like, share below, send us a message, connect, Elemental Awakening. We love to hear from you guys. So let's jump into it. So Jeff, tell me a bit about your story, because I know you weren't always, you know, this long-bearded, spiritual, hippie necklace. That's how we met, first of all. I think you gave me a bracelet and I gave you a necklace, and then from there
that's
we were
right.
just like connected.
Right.
So tell me a bit of the old Jeff and the life you came from, and what brought you to your path that you're on today.
Okay, the old Jeff. Well, many lives lived. However, to go into that, yeah, I mean, where to start? Yeah, teenage years, I was pretty heavily involved in the narcotics business for a long time. And I didn't realize until later years how much that was really tormenting me inside. I fractured myself from my sense of self for a long time. Dealt with a lot of guilt and shame around being in that business, and you know, I compensated for that with resorting to alcohol as my tool to self-medicate, and you know, it snowballed for years. So I got into narcotics at quite a young age. In my early 20s, I started to get a bit paranoid and really started to derail, started drinking heavily. And when I say heavily, like, I was the last Viking type, like, you know, 200 drinks a week probably for a decade, almost two decades of my life. You know, really unbalanced, hyper-masculine energy, toxic masculinity. I was the alpha male and everything, right? Who could fight the most, who could fuck the most, who could drink the most, and I was pretty good at all of them at one point. And early 20s, I really started to dip with my just emotional well-being, and just further masked it with more consumption, got heavier into narcotics, with further distance myself from my own sense of spirit. And challenging times. Around the age of 32, I came to the point where I couldn't live with my thoughts anymore. I couldn't sleep unless I was buckled drunk, after hours, 2-3 times a week, you know, just trying to find some sense of belonging, multiple women. And I was beating myself up for a long time, like, I can't be depressed. That was the thing, like, I couldn't allow myself to admit that I was struggling as heavily as I was. I beat myself with a dummy stick. I was supposed to be this alpha male, leader of a crew, tough guy who had a lot of people working underneath him. And there's no effing way that I could show my weakness, or perceived weakness at the time, what I thought was my weakness. But I finally let the guard down. And when I was 32, I felt like Tony Soprano going in to see a psychiatrist, as I was, you know, I was a pretty heavy hitter in the business. And I went to see a psychiatrist and just walked in. It was like, yo, I'm fucked up. Like, I don't even know where to begin. And, you know, this poor woman at the back who had a PhD in psychiatry, but I can't imagine she had any kind of cases like mine that were coming in. You know, this guy who was just tormented inside, still knee deep in the drug business, and just trying to work his way through it. So that was the first stepping stone for me to being real with myself and getting me on somewhat of a path of, I like to call it spiritual health as opposed to mental health.
Mm-hmm.
I think through my education, what I've been through, the spirit takes on messages that turn into beliefs that crystallize in the being, and it's the spirit that's actually unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
So that snowballed from, you know, the psychiatry ran its course, you know, came to a point where I remember I was making an analogy to the psychologist, you know, why am I struggling so heavily with my line of work, which at the time was cocaine. And I was comparing it to Big Pharma, like why am I dealing with all this guilt when we have, you know, doctors and hospitals prescribing things like Oxycontin to patients and people, which is hillbilly heroin in my eyes. And I remember my psychologist making a judgment, being like, "Ha, like don't get it twisted, like you sell cocaine." Not to say that I'm trying to say that I was doing something good for humanity, but life isn't so cut and dry on what is, you know, perceived as good and bad. And that ran its course. And as soon as that judgment came on, I said, "Okay, see you later." And I sought out more of a spiritual advisor of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
So I had some one-on-ones, which were, I can't say too beneficial, but that's when I really started to get on my path. And he offered me to go into, to check out a course called Vipassana Meditation.
Oh, cool.
And I like to say that that was one of the choices that saved my life, as at that time, like I was knee deep still in just debaucherous lifestyle. And somehow I said, I got nothing to lose, like, let's do this. So Vipassana meditation is, you go on retreat for 10 days, complete silence, meditate for 8 hours a day. So this, at the time, walking, disaster, but a man who was struggling heavily with his well-being, 200 drinks a week, just said, yeah, okay, let's do it. And
can't imagine what that might be like. Vipassana, you're 200 drinks a week, you're still a little bit lost.
Height of debaucheriness.
And someone's telling you, this would be good for you. Cold turkey, silence.
Yeah.
You know, and there's one thing about, I know what that sort of mindset can feel like when you're in that sort of lifestyle. Just go, go, go. You know, alcohol, drugs. Your mind's buzzing. It's always flying around like a million miles an hour.
Oh, I was tormented. I had 5 effing phones at one point.
Wow.
I could not gather myself for the life of me. And in a highly dangerous business to not have your head on straight too, you know, poof.
So tell me, what was Vipassana like to you? So you go in there, did you know what you were expecting? Do any research whatsoever?
Very minimal. I just knew it was silence for 10 days, and it was actually great. It wasn't as challenging as people have made it seem to be. It's gonna be the most daunting thing in your life, could be super challenging, you wanna leave. And I was chilling. I was, you know, people talk too much sometimes, and I had a good remembrance of that. I mean, the first time, to be honest, the first 7 days, I sat in there, and all I could think about, sorry, can I swear on this?
Yeah.
Okay, all I could think about was, this motherfucker did this, this guy did that, that guy robbed me for that, this woman, you know, did this, and I was carrying so much anger and resentment outwards, and I couldn't even detach from it. That was all that was in my field. That was it. And then finally, by the 7th day, I had this like awareness. It was like, holy shit, is this everything that I was carrying in my energy field? And I just had this big release, and really got me present to just how much I'd been storing up, this built up resentment and a lot of anger with myself, really, for choices I had made. And it was a powerful 10 days. You know, by the 9th day, your senses are so heightened, and you can just like see a butterfly floating over there, a piece of plastic that's not meant to be there, and you're just buzzing with this electricity. So, I mean, I came out of there and back to this drawing board. I was not like some healed guru where I came out and was all of a sudden a meditator, but slowly but surely, one foot in front of the other, went for a second Vipassana. I trimmed down maybe to 150 drinks a week, down to 100, down to 50, down to 20, and just started to integrate more mindfulness practices and, you know, just getting deeper on the spiritual path. And
did the people you were associating with, did they know something was going on? Or did you tell them you were going to meditate? And, you know, because I could see that alpha male style position now going a different path. Was it a sign of weakness? Were people questioning you? Were people curious? Well, how was that in your circles?
It was received really well, actually. I made it so much bigger in my own head than it was. You know, I opened up about my struggles with depression, and, you know, looking back, it probably didn't take Einstein to figure out, like, I was pretty, yeah, I mean, you know, man who's consuming like I was, like, I wasn't masking it as well as I thought I was. So I kind of opened up and let the guard down and just really started to come clean with things. And that's when I feel at that moment in my life, I was in this unhealthy, prior to 32, I was in this unhealthy alpha male. And then I swung the pendulum so far and got into this unhealthy, like, feminine energy where I was, like, overtly compassionate. I let the world walk all over me. And I was really sensitive, like, overly sensitive. And just felt like a doormat for life. You know, attracted some really interesting relationships, to say the least. That was a lot of learning experiences.
How old are you now?
39.
39, okay.
So, yeah, you know, it was one step in front of the, one foot in front of the other, just, and then I, you know, there was a big shift, actually, that occurred, looking back, another choice that saved my life. I was, there's a woman who was a musician had this idea that she was going to get me to be a financial investor in her music, but also this movement that she wanted to create called Bold and Centered, which was a movement to inspire humanity to stand bold in their beliefs, remain centered in your heart, is what I converted to afterwards. And at the time, I didn't have any background in the music business. I'm like, yo, like, why are you coming at me? Like, I don't, this isn't my line of work. You know, and she was persistent. And I said, okay, you know what? Like, if you want me to financially back you, like, you got to perform for me. And I mean, I don't know, do we have time to get into a little funny story?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah? Yeah. I don't want to get too off track here, but. So she set up a performance for me with her and her band. But at that time, I had lost a girlfriend of mine. We weren't dating at the time, but we had a special connection. And I had no idea how much she meant to me until she passed away. Very kindred spirits, died way too young, severely self-medicating. And it rocked my world. Like, I was just floored, walking zombie. I didn't think it was humanly possible to, like, go as hard as I was going with consumption of alcohol and drugs, after hours, five nights a week, like, dangerous stuff. A lot of people worried about me.
This is after Vipassana or before?
This is after Vipassana.
Okay.
Anyways, so this girl sets up sets up this concert for me. And this is the day after my homegirl's funeral. And I've been drinking the whole night before. And she sets up this concert and I'm nowhere to be found. And finally I get up, I go to this concert. She blows me away, incredibly, incredibly talented musician. So, you know, I don't know if I should share this one, but I'm on stage. At the end of the concert, I grabbed the mic and I want to address the crowd just to apologize for, you know, the delay. So I grabbed the mic and I'm like, yeah, you know what, guys, I lost somebody last night. Like, you know, I forgive me. And then I grabbed the microphone, and keep in mind that they're there for her music and also this movement, Bolton Center, which is a movement to inspire humanity to live a life of service. It's about equality and things of that nature. So I grab the mic, I get on the mic, and I say, well, I'm in. I'm like, but I'm also more than just an investor. I'm like, I also rap. So I grab the mic, and she's got all of her marketing people there, all of, you know, communications, and I'm like, crowd's silent, eh? So I'm like, they used to call me Lord Jeppy, that was my nickname. I'm like, I'm Lord Jeppy, ain't nothing nice. If you ever get me mad, then I'll fuck your wife. And I dropped the mic and get off stage. That's how much I was in my toxic masculinity at the time. So all the girls are freaking out. All the guys in the car are like, whoop, 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 whoop. Oh, man. Just a walking train wreck at that time. Oh, fuck. I forgot about that. And, but from that moment on, I said I was in, and we started this, you know, I was a financial backer. We ended up falling in love, had a relationship, mixing business with pleasure. But she brought me to this movement called Bold and Centered, which ended up being my saving grace. She got, you know, things were really rocky between
us. So when you say saving grace, in what way? Like, what changed within you? Like,
it gave me purpose.
Okay.
It gave me purpose onto what my true path was.
And how important do you think that is, finding your purpose? Does it push you in a direction? Does it pull you forward? Like, the word purpose, I think a lot of people don't understand it because they haven't found it yet. You know? So how can you describe that feeling? Like, what did that mean to you, that purpose at that time? Is it something you hadn't found previously?
It was something that was laying dormant. I always, even during my times in the narcotics business, times of severe depression, I always, my biggest motivation was my people. Like, I was always the guy who would die for my people, and a lot of people loved and trusted and respected me for that. And I'd always have boat cruises every year, free ones, you know, investing in people's startups or helping people out wherever I could. It was always, I love the people. I was, and I don't want to sound egotistical, I'm not no modern day Pablo Escobar, I would always be giving back, you know? I didn't keep any money at all, really. And I was really confused. I didn't care to be in that field of work, but depression kept me in it for a lot longer than need be. I had so little self-worth that I didn't think I could do something outside of that. So back to the question about purpose, the community outreach programs, Bold and Centered, Stand Bold in Your Beliefs, Remain Centered in Your Heart, was really, I had this big, huge vision that I wanted to cultivate for a movement of inspiring beings to be of service to humanity. And when my partner walked away and she was the face of it, she was everything, I was left to decide, am I able to take this on my own? And I said, you know what? Yeah, I'm up for the task. Let's do this. And from there, I started to do work in Toronto community housing projects in the West End called the Swansea Muse, where we did a pop-up barbecue. I had a friend from high school reach out and say, hey, like, you know, I'm from this community, I want to give back. And I said, okay, just set, pick a date. I got the people, a lot of musicians. So we went in and we set up. Sure enough, as soon as we get there, police were on the scene, and you know, my conditioning, my programming is automatically like red turn. But I was like, wait a second here, like, we're doing something cool here, an event to give back to the community. And sure enough, one of the officers was good friends with a friend of mine who they went to training school together. And so we had this beautiful event, and then he said, hey, like, I can get access to a gymnasium. Do you want to put on a weekly basketball program for these youth? So that snowballed into a weekly basketball program. And from there, the community, the Toronto Community Housing Project, heard about us, and they reached out to us. And that led to like a summer activities camp. And we did every year an annual barbecue, which got bigger and bigger. And yeah, I had this grand vision where I wanted Bold and Centered to be this incubator organization for people who had projects that were aimed at being of service to humanity. And we'd have grant writers on board. We'd have this big social media platform and just plug and play. But, you know, at the same time, so I was doing all this philanthropic work, working with local mayors, were coming up to my events, shaking hands with, we were working with ProAction Police, but I still had one foot knee deep in the underworld. And just this tug of war, and I couldn't get out at the time. I made some mistakes financially, and $20 an hour at a job wasn't gonna pay him off. So I felt like entrapped in this line of work, and I was struggling heavily. And you know, probably one of the biggest blessings that I had, looking back, was you know, I can call him a gentleman now because I've given him full forgiveness. A gentleman who, I'll say, was working under me, he got caught, and he gave me up to save his own skin. So I was living with my girlfriend at the time, who I had started that organization with. So I'm backtracking a bit here. Long story short, I came home, or was at home, I got my door kicked in, got caught with heavy amount of narcotics. That was enough to land me 4 years in prison. So, I mean, at that stage, I was transitioning out. That was my intention. I was just doing enough to pay the bills, pay off some debts. And when I got caught, I still stayed in the business for a bit because I had to. I was no way to pay the lawyer fees and just didn't have the capacity, the emotional well-being to try and put my energies elsewhere. But leading up to, so that was a big event for me, because leading up to the trial.
Did you end up going to jail? Did you?
No. So that's what I was going to lead into.
Okay.
I was facing 4 years behind bars, and about 2 months before the trial date, you know, at this point I had really done a lot of work on myself and gotten much more in a healthier mind state. And 2 months before the trial, I remember just saying to God, just, you know, if my time is better served in jail, I'll accept that. If it's not, you know, do something about it here. And I gave up the business. At the time, previously, I used to have a driver who, my full-time driver. I said, the business is yours. Like, I'm done. I don't want to see a penny. I don't want to hear about anything. And the universe rewarded me when I went to go to trial. The case was dissolved on the fact that the police had a lot of holes in their case of how they obtained the warrant. And that was, from there, that was the biggest shift in my life, was getting out of the drug business. That was just
a lot of fear when it was coming up, like just getting
trial.
Yeah, like how, what were you thinking? Like, what was going through your mind at that time about, like, your life? Right, it's a huge, could go either way.
Yeah, it was an interesting period, because it was a 2 year period from when I got caught to when the trial was coming up. And a lot of shifts were occurring. I had been like, you know, sometimes I'm like an old soul. Sometimes I really need to like embed certain ways of being into me before they get really solidified. And I was slowly getting out of the business. And it was just like, I slowly gave up drinking over 6 years, from 200 drinks a week to none. Like, everything to me has to be grinding, but like things stay in my being. Mm-hmm. Once I shift habit patterns. I'm not an overnight guy. I'm speeding the process up now, I'll say, but I don't want to put that on me. But during that time, yeah, it was a tough period in a lot of ways, of the unknown, right? Like, you don't know if you're gonna, what can you plan? Can you plan a life with a woman? Can you, you know, can you plan a future for this movement that I was talking about, Bolden Centered? But during that time, Bolden Centered is what really had saved me in my course of directional shift. I was really passionate about giving back and working with the youth, and thinking that through my experiences that I can relate to a lot of people and struggle in a lot of different ways. The drug business taught me many, many different beautiful things, and a lot more compassion for people who are suffering on many different levels. But it was an interesting time leading up to that. But I had really surrendered to the possibility of going in. The thought of going in didn't represent any fear.
I guess my question would be, like, did you feel like a lot of the people in that sort of line of work were also hurting and had a lot of pain and just felt like this was all they had and they were just in this fight? Because I know a few other people that I talked to that were in that business felt like everyone was hurt there, and everyone was masking their pain with like power and strength and like wanting to fight and be the best and making money. Do you think that rings true, or was that more your own sort of journey? It was like you just wanted.
I mean, I think definitely amongst my peers, I struggled with embracing that line of work the most. You know, I could see that being truth for a lot of people. I was on a pretty high scale, and a lot of the bigger boys in that industry were pretty content with what they're doing. And, you know, in that line of work, you meet the solidest people and the scummiest people. Mm-hmm. You know, people who you have to trust your life with on a day-to-day basis, really. And they're really people who don't necessarily just conform to mainstream society's way of living, which I never did either, and I still don't. You know, I see a lot of holes in necessarily the, you know, how how am I trying to say this? Yeah, the mainstream or just,
society in general.
I'm finding my path on that, right?
Like, so let's talk about the Western society. So the trial happens, you get off.
I say I'm done. I get out of the business. I get the case released. Huge blessing. And, sorry, I interrupted you. You didn't even ask me the question.
No, it's okay. We're just flowing with it. I was just talking about, you always sort of answered it about, like, people in general, and if you felt like they were in pain or not, and you felt that, you know, it was a wide range of people, and it could be anyone, I guess, in any kind of business, just people who are hurting, people who are not. But then more than that, it's like, okay, so what happened next? Like, what happened after this whole thing was over? You got a second lease on life, I guess. God answered your question. What did you choose to do next? Was there, like, an urge to go back, or were you, did you know that it was time for something new?
No, I gave it up and never looked back. Yeah, I was ready. I was really ready. I was so done with it. So done. Just thinking about it, like, that was the biggest choice I ever made, was to get out of the drug business, and it's been...
You don't miss it at all?
I mean, you know, sometimes when the ego pops up, and I'm still... I have a lot of people who I still love in that line of work, and because of where I was with my emotional struggles, and just, I was on a pretty big playing field, and I didn't put away any money. I was burning through money left, right, and center. So sometimes I'm like, I look at my peers who, you know, franchise restaurant owners, yachts, all this stuff, and there's the ego that's like, oh, it would be nice, and then I think, no, absolutely not. Like, I wouldn't change anything for the world, for the choices that I made, the experiences that I had to go through, and for getting out when I did. I don't miss it at all. No, it's been a blessing.
So what happened after that? Because I know you found the plant medicine. I want to talk a bit about that. But okay. Was there a gap in between the trial and you really finding yourself, or what happened after?
So after the trial, when the case was dissolved, shortly thereafter, I put a stop to what I was doing with Bold and Centered. I got out the business, and I just had to do me. I had so much repressed emotion, so much just chaotic in my mind. As I said, I lived with 4 or 5 phones for a decade of my life, 200 drinks a week. Like, I was not spiritually healthy still, even though I had been on this path. I had come a long ways, but I needed to just detox from everybody. Like, I had to completely cut myself off from people who I loved, but I couldn't do that weekend warrior stuff anymore. I couldn't connect with the old boys and watch sports and talk about chasing women on the weekends. I couldn't be around my associates, and I had to, you know, doesn't make it easier when people are calling you and you have the opportunity to, hey, like, you know, I can make that quick bread, but so I had to really let go of the life that I knew, and things started to transition. I had met a partner at the time who was really, really gifted woman who opened me up to a larger community in Toronto and started to shift kind of my circles and events that I'd be going to, as opposed to the bars I was going to, channeling sessions or things of that nature. But I mean, the big choice, though, after the case was dismissed, I decided to sell my house in Toronto and go to the jungle. I just had to do me, and I could have easily kept that house and had a comfortable life, but I knew there was more out there. I needed to just let go of, like, those security blankets that sometimes can prevent you from, you know, your biggest growth.
So how did you get called to the jungle? Was it something you knew you wanted to do? Did it start, like, how did that, what's that process like?
To be honest, I was strongly called, just the jungle was calling me. And it was Africa that was really calling me for a long time. Okay. And the intention was to go to Africa and just go deep into deep jungle, connect with some tribes. I had some romantic visions of sitting around a campfire, beating war drums with face paint on, you know. But, excuse me, my travel time shortened from 6 months to 3.5 months. And I thought, you know, Africa feels to me it needs to be honored for minimum, like, 5-6 months. So that shifted to Peru. and I ended up going to the jungle in Peru.
Okay.
Yeah.
And were you, was your intention to do plant medicine when you went down there, or did you find it when you got there?
Not at all. Intention was just to connect with the jungle. I had two intentions. One was a complete disconnect to reconnect, and another one was to reestablish my relationship with Christ.
Okay.
So
jungle, Christ, ayahuasca. How did those things all come together?
Okay, so journey to the jungle, I was blessed to have a brother in Toronto who had lived there about 10 years prior, connected me with an incredible gentleman who's actually an absolutely incredible painter, Ayahuasca Visions. So I landed in a town called Pucallpa, and right away my intention was deep jungle. I didn't want to be in any towns, be around any cell phones, cars. I wanted to be in the jungle, fishing, living off the land, no electricity, like off the beaten path. I wanted like negative headspace where I just figure out, just get back to some sense of self. Like, but you know, the universe has its own plans, and it's like, no, you gotta put in some time here first. So when I got there, the family I stayed with, their home was under construction. I mean, these homes are more or less houses on stilts that are backing onto the Amazon River. And I took it upon myself to build this family a happy home. I had just sold my house in Toronto, and I thought, you know what, let's do something to give back here. So as opposed to going, getting this disconnect, I spent the first 6 weeks being a home renovator and building these guys a home. Now, during that time, I found myself visiting. There was only one foreigner hangout in Pucallpa, which was great. You could walk around there and be the only foreigner, which I thoroughly enjoyed. But I found myself going to this one internet cafe, juice bar, like daily, connecting with people back home, surfing the web. It's like not what I was intending to do out there. But it served its purpose, because when I went there, you know, I had always said to the universe, you know, I wasn't going down there searching for ayahuasca, like a chicken with its head cut off. I said to myself, if it finds me, I'm gonna stay open to it. And sure enough, I met a couple there, who, one from the States, gentleman from Canada, woman from the States, who ran a retreat center outside of Pucallpa. And at that time, I was getting a little bit stir crazy. I still wanted to go to the deep jungle with my friend's family, but that wasn't materializing. So I said, you know what, let's go check out this retreat center. And the intention at the time was I was gonna come back after my time with this family and potentially do ceremony. However, I ended up going there and started to, and partook in ceremony there. So that was how the journeys with ayahuasca began. Boy, get into that?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, you went deep with the medicine. I remember maybe a year or two of not seeing you, I saw you at that park that day, and you had a totally different look. I think you had a shaved head. You're telling me how you were just in the jungle and drinking a lot of medicine, and you learned a lot of things. So tell me how, like, ayahuasca changed your life. Like, what happened when you found the medicine? Did you connect with Christ?
This one's a deep story. I don't know if we got like a time, but I can try and expedite it.
Sure, yeah, totally.
So when I went to this first retreat center, I worked with a shaman there. My first instincts were like, sometimes those analogies of light and dark doesn't always sit well with me. For better or work, we'll say it, carry like a heavy energy, we'll say the shaman. But I had never done any work previously, and who am I to judge? These are Shipibo, jungle people. And I actually had a good experience with them. First journey I had this entity come up in me and like, pinned my fingers up like this, and it felt like there was this hair in my throat, and I kept on trying to pull it out, like, ah, ah. And I was at war with this entity that was in me, and that was challenging session, that one for sure, just going back and forth. And I recognized, you know, I always wanted to go to war with these perceived attacks or these perceived uncomfortable energies and trying to like shoot them down, and literally this being was taking over my body, and like, it was an interesting journey.
Do you think there was actually like an entity? Well, do you believe in that kind of stuff?
I definitely do. I connected down the line what that was. I've been recently getting into this program called Holographic Kinetic Healing with an Aboriginal gentleman from Australia, and he speaks on outside interference of entities that can come into your energy field from agreements that are made, from opening up yourself energetically in unsafe containers. And during a session when I was on the table, it came that there was a gargoyle that was in my field. And I connected that to my first ayahuasca session when my fingers were literally pinned up like this, like a little gargoyle, and trying to pull out my tongue. You know, gargoyles have those long tongues that come out. Because prior to that, I was still unsure about this whole, like, exterior entities and things, you know. Like, I don't like to give power to things outside of self. Like, usually I prefer to say these are just aspects of self that are coming out. But when I tied that in from that holographic kinetics course, from that session to the first ayahuasca session I have, I definitely fully believe that there's entities that can come into our energy field. And I'm super mindful now about the potential of even opening up my energy field. So,
Do you think you're more susceptible to these entities if you're doing things that lower your vibration, like drugs and alcohol, like all that part of your life where you're just really all over the place, allows these things to sort of latch on?
110%.
And then, so do you think that you can naturally, well, maybe not naturally, but like my belief is if that is true, then by raising your vibration, if you would oscillate at a different level where they can no longer sort of stay attached to you, as long as you stay like lower. So like when you did ayahuasca that first time, it was maybe trying to come out because like you're raising your vibration, right? You think that's possible? That's how I see it anyways, that like...
I definitely... Hearing what you're saying resonates with me in terms of like once you're raising your frequency, no longer those lower vibrational beings can stay in that energy field and they gotta go. That's very possible. I never even considered that, to be honest. That's very possible. Yeah, it was coming out. It was ready. It was.
And that's why a lot of times they come to the surface in these kind of experiences, because the medicine is trying to help you bring these things out. Mm-hmm. And now it's up to you to now get that final awareness. It's like, you know, to make some changes, to raise my vibration. These things no longer serve me. So you purge sometimes. You see crazy things. I'm sure in my ayahuasca sessions, I've seen things that look like entities, look like scary shit, whether they're trying to come in or trying to go. But I've noticed, you know, like the more medicine I do, the less of that I get. The more I make changes in my life and the more I'm being of service, I'm a daily practice of meditation, I feel like my vibration is higher, my ceremonies are much more pleasant, you know, and I'm learning more rather than cleansing more, if that makes sense, you know? So that's my perspective anyways. It's hard to say for certain, right? Because it's such an ambiguous state. It's so like hard to put a finger on the whole experience. Like I've heard perspectives from all different types of shamans, all different types of psychiatrists, or like people who are into medicine, psychonauts, and everyone's got a different perspective of what is actually going on. So, you know, I love hearing it, but personally it's hard for me to ascribe to any one thing. It's okay, what rings the most truth for me? Right?
So, yeah, there's no you know, one person's ceremony, you can't even almost cross-reference because it is so different for everybody, you know, that medicine, I find.
So you have this experience.
So I had that experience, this demonic entity coming up. I'm at war with it. I ended up doing a 10-day retreat there. So ceremony every other day. Good experience. You know, second day too, I had that energy coming up again. Shaman kind of pinpointed that it had an animal spirit in my throat is what she shared. Now, I don't know if that's attached to the entity or not. I don't necessarily think so. May have been, which resonated deeply with me too, because a lot of mediums and a lot of energy workers would always say my throat chakra, there's always been blockages there. You know, I had past lives where I was hung apparently, which I'm sure most of us have had. And I've always had the story that I can't express myself.
And you believe in all past lives and stuff like that too?
Most definitely, yes.
Have you had any experiences in like ayahuasca or other where you've witnessed past life? And if so, what do you think about like the purpose of all these lives? Are we going somewhere or we just keep coming back?
I have not had any experience where I've tuned into a past life. So that's not, you know, the reason why I believe in it.
So you believe it from a theoretical perspective more? Like it makes more sense?
There's a theoretical And it's just like a deep knowing that resonance. It's just, a deep knowing.
So, do you think we're locked in this cycle of reincarnation, or do you think there's a way to break out?
For me, I think we're in this cycle of reincarnation until we complete almost, I want to say, like our karmic loops, until we're able to learn the lessons that we're meant to learn here on Earth and really cleanse our energy fields. Mm-hmm. And karma doesn't look to me as it does to a lot of people. A lot of people think, you know, kill somebody, you'll be killed, or it's cause and effect immediately. To me, it's not that. It's being able to feel the impact on your actions. So if you hurt somebody, you break their nose in a fight, and that person falls into a deep depression and they get on drugs, and that's a lot of the direct result from your being, I don't think necessarily that the karma is going to be you're going to now have some life-altering event, you're going to get hooked on drugs. It's like you're going to be able to feel that compassion for that act that you've actually taken. And I think there is a point in time where we've completed that cycle of, to bear with me, I'm trying to gather my thoughts to catch up with my beliefs. I feel there's a time where we are able to complete that cycle of what we're here to do on Earth almost, and vibrate up out of this physical being. I have to dive a bit more into it to really like tighten my beliefs on that. Mm-hmm. But I do think our spirits lived many lives, and this is just the physical vessel that our spirit is currently inhabiting.
Okay. Yeah, I believe somewhat similar. There's some purpose to keep coming back until we've gained all the lessons and understandings, what it takes to sort of go to another higher vibration, you know, because there's a lot of stuff here that's, I guess, challenging for certain reasons, because we've got to learn, you know. And so from that perspective, I also think that there is no such thing as good or bad. So these entities are there to teach you. They're there to push you in a certain way, to press on you, to make you feel so you can choose 100%. To walk away from selling drugs. So you can choose not to break that person's nose in the moment. You know, learn about like consequence, or learn about compassion, and learn about all these things. And eventually, I think we all experience like a life of Jesus or a life of Buddha when we get there. We get to understand that before we ascend. We get to reincarnate as one of these sort of beings that, you know, but it might take you a million lives to get there. You might be stuck for a long time, because time is an illusion in my perspective. So all these lives just continue learning. You learn, and the more, like, once you start in that awareness now, you better start investing that, because now you have that glimpse. So you're gonna be leaps and bounds ahead in your next life once you have that realization. But there's always those things like, oh, maybe I should not do this, or maybe, you know.
Well, something you just shared there about, yeah, when you, it's about compassion. Once you've been able to really understand compassion for all fellow beings, and you're able to vibrate up almost into like, yeah, the Buddhas and saints, because you're no longer in that, so much in the density almost of like that physical realm. It's something I'm still
really trying to figure.
Yeah, I'm still figuring that one out.
So
you know,
what would you say some of the biggest takeaways from your ayahuasca or shifts in your life?
So yeah, to back to the ayah, and really got clear on the power of intention. Two intentions, disconnect to reconnect, and to really reestablish my relationship to Christ. So I had pushed Christ out of my life from what I had viewed as these institutional religion, which I believe was used as a way of controlling the masses for a long time, which served its purpose. And I really pushed religion out of my life at a young age, recognizing in my older years that Christ had nothing to do with any of these institutional teachings, and I wanted to reestablish that relationship. So when I was in the jungle, I found myself like, I'd be meditating at night, and before I go to bed, like, I'd be like, yo, Jesus, like, come holler at me, like, I don't know how to go about doing this, but like, I'm here, and I'm ready to like to connect. And even that in itself is planting seeds energetically, even though I had no idea what I was doing. So long story short, with the medicine, ended up doing 2 10-days at this first retreat in a beautiful place. However, it was ran by foreigners with foreigner patients, I'll call them. And it wasn't what I had gone down there for. I wanted to go to the deep jungle. I wanted to connect with indigenous culture. I wanted to be off the beaten path. So again, that internet cafe served its purpose and guided me to a town in the deeper jungle called Pau Yung, where, so I was told, is like, you know, their shamans have been living out there for their entire lives and really well known for their shamans. So I said, okay, I'm in. Made the call, and it really worked out. I told the owners of the first retreat that I was gonna go there. They said, okay, we're coming with you. And it worked out because the head of the kitchen staff happened to be married to the governor of this 800 person Shipibo tribe in the deep jungle. So everyone came with me. We all did one ceremony together, and then everybody ended up leaving except me and a woman who became like a soul sister to me. We wanted to go deeper with that medicine. So
tell me, what was it like? Was it like little huts? Was it, what did they have
houses? Yeah, little huts.
Made out of bricks, straw, mud.
It was wood with straw roofs.
Okay.
Yeah, just little shanty huts. Very, you know, basic means of living. They actually had electricity. They had just been brought in solar panels there. There's a wonderful project that happened. So they just got electricity. And to my chagrin, they actually, they just got televisions. And they'd gather around at night, one television, and watch this American Gladiators meets Baywatch. And I was like, no, because Western pollution is here too. And at night, they'd be playing so loud, like The Weeknd. And I was like, oh my God, I can't even escape this in the deep jungle. But I had some incredible experiences. I worked with two couples at first, four shamans. And these guys are such incredible curanderos. Curandero means a medicine man. And they gave me the name down there, Ranin Rawa. And the shaman I was working with, he's like, Rawa, he's like, we're gonna help you move the animal spirit in your throat. I was like, dope, let's do it. So we went on a trip in the jungle in a canoe, and he went and got some random like water lilies, tree bark, some leaves, and he prepared this concoction the morning after ayahuasca, and he'd have me breathe over this, breathing in all this, the concoction he prepared. Now at the end of it, he'd pour out the remaining remnants onto a big banana leaf, and he'd sift through it. And he calls me over, and he's like, Rawa, he's like, come look. And I look, and there's about an inch long white worm that had come out of my throat. I was like, that came out of my throat? He's like, yeah. I'm like, phew. I go, are you serious? He's like, yeah. I have to believe him. Like, we went to the jungle specifically to get the elements to remove the animal spirit in my throat. I didn't pay him any extra. There's no reason for him to have, mm-hmm. And so I did that three times. First vapor one, second vapor one, last vapor three. So that was pretty mind-blowing. I mean, this story is so deep, but that was wild, just witnessing that. And at this point, the ceremonies were really challenging for me. Super challenging. I couldn't sit with the medicine. Every ceremony I was scratching at myself. I was so consumed with purging out all of these energies and darkness that I had thought was attached to me from the line of work I was in, from the drinking, from the after hours. And I lost myself on that like loop of like purging everything out that wasn't serving me. You know, ayahuasca, you purge out physical and emotional. They say emotional trapped energy you can purge out. So I was so consumed with thinking that it's all this darkness attached to me that I couldn't allow the medicine to just take its course, in life. And I attach that to life. In life, you don't get to just purge out or throw away uncomfortable situations that are coming to you. You have to be able to transmute it, be the alchemist, and like observe it on, feelings that you're having. You don't get to just purge it out. You have to be able to observe, see what it's teaching you, and then bring love to the most uncomfortable, the darkest feelings are really the ones that need the most love, mm-hmm. with your own self and your own thoughts. And what the medicine really, it kicked my ass. Like, it kicked my ass hard. I couldn't sit.
But in a good way, though? Like afterwards, would you say you were changed because of it?
There's some more things to lead into. Like, so I had sat with these four shamans, And I thought I had hit the upper echelon of what it was possible to who to work with. You know, these beings were just, they lived in the deep jungle their entire life. They were mid-60s, just radiated this pure light energy, very pure. However, there was still a next level up to go. Now, when I first arrived, the governor had said, if you're going to get into this work, you need to sit with this gentleman who I ended up calling Big Papa. He was a 92-year-old shaman. So me and my sister went to speak with him. We ended up going to do ceremonies with Big Papa. So when I first sat with him, from the backtrack the stories a bit here, but he saw my energy field. He's like, what diet were you put on? So the first place I was put on a dieta with a plant called toy. Now, for those who know about what toy in itself is highly, highly hallucinogenic. It's a master plant that only people who have really walk this path should be dieting with. It's supposed to get you to see beyond the veil. Now, when I was on toe, I was literally on the boat going to the jungle. I remember one time I was eating this mango, and then in my head I was like, I don't have a mango in my hand, and then it disappeared. I'd be reading a book in my hammock, I'd read a whole page, two page, I'd go to turn it, and I'd be like, I don't have a book in my hand, be gone. And I'd literally see like beings that would come up and they'd look at me and they'd all retreat. So when I got to sit with Big Papa, he saw this in my field and he's like, whoever put you on this either was done with malintentions or lack of due diligence. We have to clear that right away. So my first three sessions with him were Olympiado, a cleansing, and then I went deeper with Big Papa, and that was a huge blessing. Just by chance, well, I don't necessarily believe in chance, but through the grace of the good Lord, there was a shaman's apprentice was there at the same time as me, a brother of mine from Switzerland, and he really helped guide me through some of the sessions. Mm-hmm. You know, again, I was super struggling with the medicine, couldn't sit with it, borderline schizophrenic. And then he asked me one time, he's like, Rawa, he's like, how you doing? I said, for better or worse, struggling. He's like, so? He's like, be with the struggle. So what? You're struggling. Be okay with it. Welcome it in. Mm-hmm. What's it showing you? What's it gonna teach you? And that's where something clicked, and I was like, okay, And he shared with me a story. He's like, when I first started to do this work, I used to try to go to war and shoot down all these energies that were coming in that felt like I wanted to go to war with them. He's like, it just never ends. He's like, you gotta welcome them in, allow them to come in. And that was such a strong teaching for me, as I had been super hard on myself for all these choices that I made and beating myself down constantly. And these perceived struggles that I was having was just all a reflection of my thoughts. Mm-hmm. And I really got clear on how destructive I was with my thoughts. And he said, OCD with picking, and I'd pick at something and never present, constantly up and living in the mind because I'd done too much damage to my heart. And finally I started to be able to sit with the medicine and observe it and allow it to take its course, to come in, and you know, these perceived discomforts, I would be able to just observe them with equanimity, which is a teaching from Vipassana. And finally, as starting to be able to sit with this medicine and allow it to take its course, and you know, the last, so that was about the 17th. There was a joke, because finally, like, previous to the 17th, I'd have my pants off every ceremony, I'd be buck naked. I literally thought there was like entities behind my legs. I'd be scratching at things, like, dude, I'm not kidding, like borderline schizo. And I'd be buck naked every ceremony. So 17th one was a pants on party. And that was when I had my breakthrough. And that's when I was able to sit with these perceived discomforts. So I was a strong teacher for me in the sense that I was starting to be able to separate. I used to have really destructive thoughts with my own self, really hard on myself. And I had no idea how to separate from that.
Do you know where that came from? Was it like a childhood thing? Your parents stuff on you growing up?
Later on, just very recently, I'm still working through that, getting back into an empowered state and into taking full responsibility. I just been working recently. I had a very powerful channel message from a woman about the superego. And the superego is parental voices, institutional voices from childhood. And, you know, through my own breakthroughs of opening up with my journey, my blessing with having to navigate through depression, that I only find out that my father suffered with depression until he was in his early 60s. And that was a huge other story to get into. That was a big shift in my life. But yeah, I had taken on some deep messages at a young age that, you know, I didn't feel the world was a safe place to express my emotions, and I reverted and suppressed them from a young age, which took me out of my heart space and into my head space. And, you know, the warrior's journey back to the heart space for me has been, it's a journey to allow myself to feel. And I'm still navigating through that, like allowing myself to feel all ends of the spectrum, allowing myself to feel joy, to feel love, to feel anger, to feel pain. I had become this hardened, like, just, you know, felt like I was just, it's hard to even describe, just challenging times where I had to put on this brave front for so many years. And that self-love thing is still something that I'm incorporating in my life.
Did you find any sort of that feeling of self-love with the medicine? Did you have any of those breakthroughs in that regard? So a lot of people, like, that I've seen in ceremonies, like, first time they've ever felt self-love, but they feel their heart's, like, on fire, and they feel, like, this, like, burning energy of love and uh-huh. self-love through the medicine. Did you experience anything like that?
I had, towards the end of the journey, which I ended up doing about 22 sessions, I had, you know, back to, like, the intentions that I had set, almost to reestablish my relationship to Christ. So the shaman's apprentice had explained to me the story of who I call Big Papa. Now, from what I gather, every shaman will call in the energy or work with or diet with a specific plant or tree. Some are used for, you know, treating addictions, spiritual growth, all sorts of different shamans with different tools. Now, the shaman I worked with the Nuyarao, which is the tree of life. And the apprentice basically explained to me that this was a direct connection to source energy, Christ consciousness. And I found myself during the last few ceremonies, when I was really able to sit with the medicine and was able to allow it to just enter into my field, and they'd sing what's called your Ikaros to you, and they're opening and closing arcanas. And I remember the shaman's son was doing my opening arcanas there, and this sensation of just complete euphoria coming through, tickling like my whole being and circling throughout my body. Generally speaking, I can't lie, the sessions kicked my ass, and it really got me out of the thinking mind, the biggest, which was a huge, huge thing for me, because I was living in my head, and the medicine was just kicking my ass, getting me out of my processing mind and into my feeling body,
so many times.
Which was the biggest thing that I took from it. And I found myself, when I was leaving, prior to leaving, like, I'd be in prayer, and energetically, literally, my hands did not want to come undone. And what I took was, yeah, just that I was so much more present with my surroundings. I could feel, like, the pulse of the jungle, and just felt like connected to all that is surrounding me. So yeah, the power of intention, the fact that I had to pay my toll fees, you know, put on these diets, and I found myself in the deep jungle with a 92-year-old shaman who works with the Tree of Life. And quick story, backstory on him. So his apprentice told me first dieta he went on was the year when he was 12 years age, and Brujeria is very prevalent in the jungle. Brujeria is when other shamans can energetically attack you and literally kill through...
That's crazy. You believe in that? 100%.
Oh, that's a whole different world. It's not a world that's a joke. Mm-hmm. People in the Western world think, oh yeah, let's go get into ayahuasca. It's serious shit down there, and a lot of things I can't comprehend, but it's playing in the spirits world, and it's in the underworld as well. It's bringing up your darkness for you to be transmuted to the light. And, you know, for me, through my experiences and some of the stories that I've witnessed, I couldn't say personally, I couldn't put conviction on that, yes, this is a path for you to take. It's got to be a deep calling within that person's own knowing. It's not a joke, that world, at all.
So tell me the story about the shaman. So he's 12 years old, yeah.
So the shaman, he's 12 years old, and as I said, Brujeria was really prevalent, that shamans be jealous of each other, and so you diet with specific plants to build up your defensia, your defense to these energetic attacks. So the story goes, he did a one-year diet by himself in the deep jungle at the age of 12, and only his shaman would come from time to time and bring him food. So the shaman I worked with, he worked as a shaman until he was in his 60s. And then through his guides, he was guided to stop working with the medicine and only focus on his relationship to Christ. And he'd heal people only through prayer and through intention for a decade of his life, which is how it was put onto him. He had healed the governor's brother who was left for dead. And then when he's in the mid-70s, his angelic team or his guides had guided him back into working with ayahuasca. So it just got me, you know, incredible story, an incredibly gifted shaman. Like, I was super blessed to have been guided to him, you know, like.
Yeah, it's amazing. And so when you came back, do you still feel this calling for more medicine, or you're not doing medicine right now? Like, what's your...
Originally, I thought it was a path for me to follow.
That's what we spoke. You were talking about going back to the jungle and going deeper.
Originally, I thought it was a path to follow. I was planning on going back and doing a 3-month dieta with Big Papa, as I did, you know, 93 years old now, that I wanted to take advantage of the opportunity. But that was the intention. I went back to Peru. I was going to work on a permaculture project for a month in the Andes and then go to the deep jungle. But things shifted for me. I had a deep reawakening when I worked in the Andes. I actually was very blessed to connect with a tribe called the Quiros tribe, who live in the high mountains of Peru, who are highly regarded as the spiritual advisors of the Incan Empire. And they've lived 5,000 meters above sea level and since pre-Incan times. And story goes that they only descended down the mountains to reconnect with civilization 50 years ago. How much you believe that? It's up to you. But I went to go visit them, and I had a reawakening of, like, you know, on this path back to this self-discovery again, after I'd fractured myself so far from sense of self, I went out trying all these different things, Taoism, Buddhism, all these gurus, teachers, ayahuasca, looking externally for the answers that I know reside internally. And with the Quiros, they work with all the natural elements, Mother Earth, Father Sky, they, you know, call the energies of the Apus, the mountains. And, you know, I was trying to get to the jungle, but I just kept on being halted, and I started listening deeper, and there's this reawakening for my own being that I was no longer to look externally for these aids, for these tools at this present moment. So at this moment, I don't feel called to using any mind-altering substances, and choosing to empower my spirit with, you know, through breath work, through my connection to Mother Earth, using fire, things of that nature. So that shifted in a big way, as I thought originally it was a calling to really work with deeper with plant medicine. And I'm finding, you know, my truce with that, because I do, it's not something to be taken lightly, that work. You have to do it in a really, really solid container and make sure that the people you're working with are of high integrity, because you're opening yourself up energetically to a lot of possibilities. And it's something that you don't go into lightly, you know. So I'm finding,
so what
my
would you recommend to people who are sort of feeling that calling like you did that right now? Is there any advice you'd give them, as far as, you know, people who are listening right now, they're considering trying ayahuasca, is there anything that you'd say to them?
I definitely recommend to really, really listen to yourself. And I find there's a lot of people who are on the search for some sense of, you know, self-fulfillment, and they're turning to plant medicines, or if they're depressed and struggling, they'll look for that. I don't necessarily think that is the route to be taking. Like, you want to go into that kind of work with some solidity of your own well-being prior, because it can really bring up a lot of darkness. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I'm a bit of a cowboy and do things in my own way, but if you're gonna be, if it's a choice that you're making to get into that work, I just highly, highly recommend that you do your due diligence in terms of connecting with shamans that are in high integrity, and trust your guides, trust yourself, meet them prior, because there's a lot of stories, especially in the jungle, of shamans who aren't in such high integrity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I encourage anybody who has a true calling to that to just connect with people who've experienced it, do your research, meet the shamans prior, and make sure that you have a really good feeling and trust your intuition that, you know, those are the right shamans to be working with. And don't go into it lightly. It's something that you need to prepare yourself for in advance.
Cool. Thank you. And so what's next for you? What's next on the bucket list? Are you getting back into work now? Are you still spiritually exploring a little bit of both?
Right now, the main project's been, I have some land up north in Gravenhurst where I'm building a off-grid seasonal cottage / retreat space. Been facing some challenges. My cowboy ways caught up to me. I did things without permits and I've had to backtrack and finally just caught up. So it seems like I'll be building on the lake pre-winter like I usually do. So that's been the main project focus right now. And I'm still very much taking my time to get into alignment with me before I truly dedicate to like a bigger project. I have a deep passion to give back, and I'm still taking some time to nurture and heal myself from the long line of work that was fracturing me from sense of self.
So if people want to get a hold of you, are you available on social media? Do you have a website, anything like that, where people can connect if they have questions or want to connect with you? Or do you try to keep like off the grid?
Well, you know what? I've actually welcomed I was off of it for a while as I was doing me. But I set the intention now to come out and start sharing more. Really open myself up to be seen, to be heard, as those are hurdles that I've had to overcome. And this is actually, you know, big milestone for me to be on this podcast. And I appreciate you seeing some value in having me on this. And I actually had a woman today reach out and ask me to be on her show, and for me being a representation of the divine masculine. So she's actually setting me up with a YouTube channel, as I've been sharing short videos kind of on my journey, cool, some of the challenges I've been facing. So yeah, Facebook, Jeff Lardon, GeoffLarden. I'm on, what's the other thing called that
Instagram. I used
to? Instagram, thank you. I'm on Instagram.
Speaking like a true jungle boy.
I don't even know my handle. I think it's Jeff Lardon too, GeoffLarden. Soon to come, YouTube channel too, apparently.
We'll put the links in the description for this podcast so people can connect if they want to. But yeah, thank you guys for listening. Thank you, Jeff, for being here, sharing so much intimate stuff with us. And hopefully it resonates with people and they find some sense of direction or some answers they're looking for in their life, or helps them along their path. And I always say, if anything I say or Jeff says that resonate with you, that's sort of a sign to look deeper into that. It doesn't necessarily mean if you said ayahuasca, like, oh, I need to do ayahuasca now. But really what that, how that felt in your heart is an intuitive sort of guide. And like, look deeper into it, you know, see what it really means. There might have been a few things that could have stood out. In every podcast I know that I listen to, is one or two things that I jot down. It could be the name of a book, could be something that someone said. So just pay attention to that guide. It's your best guide. It's going to take you down some interesting paths, and some that might not seem good or right at the time, but always in the bigger picture, every path, every challenge, every experience is important in this journey, because it all has teachings in it. So that being said, I just want to give a big thank you to you, brother, for coming and sharing. I want to thank you guys for listening. Again, like, comment, share, follow this guy, stay connected, and we'll see you guys soon. Any closing thoughts or words before we go?
I just want to acknowledge you and appreciate you for the work that you're doing, your commitment to service, and for seeing the value of having me on the show. It's an honor. And it's fitting that it's the first podcast, the first share from me is done with you. So I love you, brother. And you're an inspiration to me. So
thank you, man.
Thank you. Anybody who's taking this in, you know, hopefully that there's been something insightful you take from it. And yeah, make sure, you know, going into that work, it's a true calling. And again, just do your due diligence before jumping into it.
All right, guys, you heard it. Take care. And we'll see you guys soon. Thank you.